coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew. With me always is the Jedi Cole Houston. He's sharpening his claws because we have a very special show for you tonight. Kind of called an audible after this weekend. We decided that we had to talk about Wolverine in the movies. The Logan movie has, I know we're evergreen, but we're going to talk about the Logan movie. And trust me,
we kind of had to, bub.
Your healing factor can't help your feeling factor on this one, ladies
wow.
and gentlemen. Yeah.
That is nice.
Thanks. It took me like 20 minutes of sitting there just railing my brain trying to figure out what I was going to say. Holy shit, this movie. But yeah, we wanted to talk about, you know, this movie and also how we got here. You know, is this the Hobbit's journey? This is from here to this there. This is the true hero's journey that took James Howlett to Wolverine and then to Logan. Because I'll tell you right off the bat, not to make with the funny too soon, you know, but trying to explain to someone, like I was sitting next to Old Hollywood when we were watching this movie, and he opens the file for Laura's. Oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, at the top, and we'll mention it in the notes, if you haven't seen it before you listen to this episode of Hey Kids
Comics, it would be a good idea to have already seen Logan.
We are going to spoil the shit out of the movie. So, and by the way, this movie is rated, this podcast is rated hard R. I will show my boobs once. Cole is going to yell the word shit at me from the back of a weird Cadillac limo. And, going to be a good show all around. But yeah, oh my god. Yeah,
and I will before the opening titles begin, I will have a sort of ale butt shot.
Nice. Thank you. Good. Good. Your clone, your weird de-aged clone will have a veiled butt shot.
Right.
But
back when I had a veiled butt.
So I'm I like to go to Veiled Butt, Montana when I can. Nice. The scenery.
You know what they grow there?
Vistas.
Logan berries.
God damn. So sitting next to Old Hollywood when he opens up the dossier for Laura and it says Father James Howlett. And Jason's like, who the fuck is James Howlett? And I'm like, damn it. Okay, so that's Wolverine. Well, I thought Logan was his name. Well, his name is Logan, but his name's also James Howlett. That's his Civil War name.
That's right.
And then it's like trying to explain this is impossible. I'm glad that they did put James Howlett in there, though, as a callback to
original. Yeah, not only is it there in print, but it's also spoken at one point, because I think they are the Traveling Howletts, if I'm not mistaken. Theatrical troupe who were just passing through and happened to meet a delightful family who live on a remaining farmland that apparently is has its water supply at the behest of an evil corporation of hillbilly assholes.
We're gonna jump around a lot, but Jason brilliantly, Old Hollywood brilliantly points out. So that was the guy there was Eric LaSalle. That was the actor who played the farmer. Eric LaSalle was in like 7 seasons of ER. He's been in a shit ton of movies. He's an acclaimed actor. And he's playing I was sitting there and I'm like, I don't know how he got cast as this farmer. Like, you know, like he is
because
an actor's actor.
The thing is, the one thing you don't want to be when Wolverine comes into town is a farmer. Did X-Men Origins not teach us anything?
Right. But Jason's like, there was a scene during that section of the movie where they go out to the pump station. The first time the guys pull up, and Eric LaSalle's character, the farmer character, pulls out the gun out of his tool bag, you know, and he's like, we won't have to use this, but it's good that we have it. And he walks out and he's talking to the guys, and then Wolverine, and then Logan says something, right? He's standing kind of behind him, and he says something to the farmers, and Eric LaSalle turns and looks at Wolverine. Like, oh shit, this is gonna happen. Yeah. All right. That's why he's like, that scene, that facial expression he gave when he turned around is the reason he got cast. That's the only reason, because it's perfect. It's like, oh, all right, this is happening right now. Okay, I'm good with this. Let's do this. But yes,
plus, was, you know, it conveys brilliantly that I thought I was going to be the tough.
Right, I thought I was going to have to do this.
My big boy pistol and my I've dealt these creeps for. In this strange sort of plot device where, for some reason, they undermine their own equipment.
Right, to run him out of his...
Yeah. I guess at that point, the crop was in full, you know...
In their giant...
It wasn't going to go anywhere. At that point, they were in apparently 24-hour harvest period.
Well, they did... Like I said, they did have giant sentinel threshers.
Well, they did, out there. They did, yeah. They,
like, I fully expected them to walk out onto the front porch and look out upon the fields and then hear... And then him just turn around, just say that life finds a way. That's and right. Then little ones come out of the. Yeah.
Well, there probably, you couldn't see it for the corn, but there were probably some little baby threshers out as well.
My memoirs, by the way, I'm titling, you couldn't see it through for the corn.
Naturally. But, you know, they also, there was a cut scene where he says something about they move in herds. Threshers moving herds.
Look, but then you get out of the back of a car and takes off her.
But we're talking about robo threshers. Can we pause for a moment about? I mean, this is a movie that exudes cool and exudes wonderful sensibilities and you know all this dynamite stuff. But one of the best high concept speculative fiction things I've seen played out on screen that set the fact that this is taking place 40 years in the future.
Yeah.
Which is not a tremendous amount of time, so it allows for things to be familiar, like, you know, a Ford Mofo or whatever they were driving. you know, we can accept that they're driving what would be kind of an older car, like the one you would buy for your teenage son 40 years from now. That, right. Like today, I don't know if this is the case, but I imagine that perhaps that particular model of truck is like the shit right now.
Right. It's either the shit right now or it's speculated that that's going to be like in 10 years. That's what the shit will look like. So that 30 years from now, they could buy it for $8,000.
Yeah, exactly. That was like right now, you're somebody, you know, you're Billy Bob somebody if you've got that truck right now. And in 40 years, it's got bald tires and you can get it for a fistful of dollars. But the auto trucks. Was that not one of the most brilliant,
so
unnecessary
cool.
plot devices that just it subtly puts you in a future period without shoving the future down your throat? Absolutely everything else is familiar. Then you get something that's just enough unfamiliar but just enough feasible because they're working on this shit right now.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
So it's little wonder everybody has to go to casinos in Oklahoma to try to hopefully make some kind of money to survive because all the trucking business has gone to robots. And the threshing business as well.
So we pick up Wolverine at the beginning of this movie. Is 2027?
I believe that's about right, yeah.
Would be where it was, and I think it was 2027. You know, he's aged to a point now where he's obviously older, and we know pretty early on that what is killing him is a combination of the fact that he's 200-odd years old.
Yeah.
And his healing factor is slowed down, and it can't stop what is essentially the adamantium skeleton on his bones from leaching into his bloodstream and basically poisoning him.
Yeah, because the original prototype Wolverines had lead skeletons.
Didn't work.
Did not work at all. Yeah, that was. No. But they were actually working on those in about the 50s. They didn't know better.
they didn't know no better.
Yeah, but they were still making lead pencil heads out of lead. I mean, you couldn't write with them, but damn, they were.
It's a cool ass conceit that it never even occurred to me that, you know, that he could, because I figured it was like early on before they talked about the fact that it was his skeleton that was poisoning him.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was probably cancer that was finally catching up to him, you know.
Yeah, a cancer that had been kept at bay for 190 years or something.
Right.
Because it just kept, you know, every time it tried to, it just kept, was in a state of constant remission, but could never really go away. That was syphilis.
And he's a driver for hire, basically an Uber driver
yeah.
for limos. and work and living across the border in Mexico, because he essentially has taken it upon himself to carry the nuclear football in the form of a an ever-growingly senile Professor X, which is the most powerful weapon on the face of the earth if left unattended.
Yeah, and I think there's some wonderful little subtleties there as well in the dialogues, in that you have what's his name there?
Caliban?
No, Fist Boy there.
Oh, Pierce.
Pierce.
Who in the comic books was a well-to-do member of the Hellfire Club. In this, Arkansas backwards, good old boy with a metal hand.
Yeah, it's like
Baton Rouge. Ooh,
he's like,
get off, y'all! No, yo. It's like, what? What is happening? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's basically an entree into Gambit. It's to get people ready for that kind of attitude. But but Pierce talks about him, his NSA classifying his brain as a weapon of mass destruction, or at one point they literally talk about him being like his brain being like a nuke bomb,
right?
Something to that effect. And I think that's just a wonderful way of presenting the gravity of the situation without having a big conversation about the gravity of the situation.
Right, for sure. And they did such a brilliant job of making you understand. If you go back and you listen to our episode on Winter Soldier,
yes,
we talk about when Falcon gets his wings. They find out that he was this one, paratrooper that used these special proprietary wings that we all know and love now as Falcon's wings. But they were held up in top secret, lock and key, double top secret, stamp on it, location.
Double secret probation.
For S.H.I.E.L.D. that nobody could get to. The next scene, he has his wings.
Yeah.
We don't have to see them going out and leading stealth
exactly.
mission to get the wings. We know that Captain America, this guy, and Black Widow can get the wings. We don't need...
Yeah, we have seen enough of Captain America and Black Widow working in concert to know that they're going to get what they need.
Right.
And that saves you from having, General Stan Lee come by and, what the hell's going on in here? I come in for a spot inspection and somebody stole the wings.
But no, you're absolutely right. And I think that that's exactly what we got in this movie.
Brilliant.
We didn't need anything that happened in the last 20 years. Or 30 years.
Well, not only that, there is a wonderful kind of, it's funny you invoked Jurassic Park, because you have a bit of a Spielbergian reveal with, was it Laura? Slash X-23, in that, you know, chances are, if you're going to see this movie, you've at least seen a commercial.
Right.
And so when you first send a handful of Reavers in to, get the little girl with the most awkward handcuffs known to man...
That
you don't have to show what's going on in there.
Right.
The gunfire sound and the yelling, and then you just have her walking out with this sort of smug, triumphant air around her. It paints a much more beautiful picture than Hollywood could have wasted 10,000 frames of film on.
But and many, many, many man hours in a editing bay doing CG. But what played that scene for me, and I know we're not talking about Logan, the character, but the movie, you have to just go see it. The thing that sold that scene for me so much more than her walking out was the reaction of the Reavers. Because she walks out and they all start walking backwards.
Exactly.
This is a 8-year-old girl, probably weighed 55 pounds, stood about 3 foot, three and a half.
Apparently, once you
tall.
Get the handcuffs on her, they come with a carrying handle because she's light enough that you could actually check her as baggage.
Right, but she comes walking out and they start stepping backwards.
Yes.
And they start pulling guns and they're like, no. And Pierce is like, everybody just stand back. And then the brutality.
Yeah, he's there, raising his Luke Skywalker hand.
Right. The brutality. So what we see is an aged Logan who has given, I don't want to say given up, but is resigned to a fate. And it's almost, there are a lot of people compare this to Westerns, which is absolutely accurate. 110%
oh, yeah, and I think that's
accurate.
Why it's rather apropos they have the scene from Shane.
Oh, God, that was so brilliant. But it's also very, very tied to, and of course, Westerns are as well, but it's very, very tied to samurai stories, which all of the Logan Wolverine stories have been. It's very, very tied to, if you're familiar with Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, that's a very Lone Wolf and Cub.
Very. The whole movie is very Lone Wolf and Cub.
Because it's an adult and a child set upon by multiple assailants, buckets of blood, and lots of blades flashing.
And it's also this idea I think I've said this on the show before, but Lacey at one point was like, isn't Wolverine, this not in reference to this movie, but isn't Wolverine supposed to be a loner? And I was like, yeah, but you can't be a loner if nobody's there to see it. It's like a tree falling in the forest, you know? That's why he's a joiner, because you can't be a loner if nobody's there to see it. So, you know, you've got this guy who for his entire life has said that he's a loner, but has always, in every instance that he possibly can, protects people, protects children. You know, he has that instinct. He whether you want to believe that he's got that animal, that pack mentality instinct or not, you know, but why do you feel he was drawn to protect or defend us from Charles, from Professor X?
I think, you know, your analog there about, you know, you can't be a lone wolf, no one's there to see you. Even the lone wolf is often within sight of the pack.
Right.
It's almost like, I don't need you, but, you know. And I think that in many ways, because he's the best there is at what he does, Charles Xavier's in a world that's now devoid of mutant kind, and it's partly, you know, we're the last of our kind, we got to stick together, because, you know, apparently Caliban helped, you know, help the Emperor track down and destroy the Jedi. Oh, wait, no. Wrong damn franchise. But, you know, yet Wolverine...
Execute Order House of M.
Oh, ow.
House of M Order.
Don't ever do that.
And Too melding. I melded too many worlds for you there.
Yes, indeed. But the thing about it is, I think he sees himself as the only one who can keep Xavier safe. And in many ways, I think he... It is within the wheelhouse of his sense of honor.
Yes.
And so he becomes rather like the Kurosawa masterless samurai who, you know, absent a true master to serve, kind of picks his battles, as it were. And he very much like the movie Sanjuro, I believe it is, where you have the reluctant anti-hero.
Right.
Who, though he does not want to be involved, can't help. But, you know, I don't want to come in and fight your battles, but you're a bunch of idiots and these guys are big assholes. Type of, you know, the analog is certainly there in that, you know, the deeper into this he gets, the more compelled he becomes to be a part of it. And I think in many ways, he's being drawn back into to 40 years ago when things mattered.
Right.
He's had
right.
decades to just kind of freeze over.
I got the feeling that it wasn't that, you're right, he's compelled by honor to do this, but also there's that part of him that after everything that the X-Men and Xavier have done for him, that this is the least he can do. You know, get him as far away from civilization. Try to make him comfortable, because they do say that a few times, like, we need to make, you know, he's comfortable, you know, try to prepare him, you know at least make him, because the idea is that as he's getting older, he's getting senile and he's having seizures, and when he has these seizures, his brain lets go, and the it is implied that there was an incident in Westchester, which, you know, if you're a nerd and you're in the movie, you're like, I know where that is.
Yeah, but I had to explain to Catherine afterwards why I was just like having a nerdgasm there in the middle of the movie, was that I'm like, no, I can't tell you yet, but
but
Westchester County is where the expansion was on Grimalkin Lane. What?
But the, and that they, you know, that he did some severe damage up there during one of these seizures. And for somebody that has spent his time trying to prove that, you know, we can, that the mutant race and the human race can coexist. And, you know, I'm sure that that, and that's the thing about how brilliant Patrick Stewart is.
Yes.
You, Hugh Jackman did a great job in this movie. Just blew it away. Just knocked it out of the park. But Patrick Stewart's portrayal of Professor X, at the point at which he's sort of crossed over into that that Steel Magnolias kind of frame of reference, where he's old enough now that he's given up the effete air that he's carried, and he's just kind of become, this is the last ride.
Oh yeah, and what's wonderful is in many ways this is layered. It's sort of like the Kurosawa, if Akira Kurosawa had directed a Hope and Crosby road picture with Sam Peckinpah.
Damn it. I kept saying this is Sam Peckinpah's X-Men to Jason. But no, damn it. Could that need
We're
somebody?
We're off on the road to North Dakota. We somebody. Certainly do get around.
By the way, that was brilliant. That we are to assume that the X-Men got to a point where they were so accepted and recognized for what they were in a world that we don't think that the world is a crossover world with like the Avengers. We know it's not, but that there are heroes, and those heroes are the X-Men. Exactly. And that they were such heroes that semi-biographical comic books were created about their exploits.
Yeah, and it's far enough along, we just have to assume something happened. There's some sort of Children of Men thing going on.
Right.
Where, I mean, and I think there's some definite framework there, because what I absolutely love about Fox's X-Men franchise is that it can simultaneously admit its mistakes, correct its mistakes, and yet playfully acknowledge that they're still part of something, even if they're not.
Well,
and in much the same way that X-Men First Class retrofit, it was sort of like it was a reboot that wasn't a reboot.
Right.
Because there were so many aspects that said, wait a minute, that's part of what you're supposed to be undoing. And there was just a wonderful line along those lines where Professor X mentions the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm. And he says, that was a long time ago,
and I
Chuck.
Thought, what a wonderful way to acknowledge something and allow you, the viewer, to rewrite everything that was wrong.
Right.
With 2008. 17 years later, it's okay to say that could have happened. It probably, hey, how about without the awkward what happens to a toad gets struck by lightning line?
Well, I think that the implication is that when you see the X-Men comic book, and this is what I carried with that, right? When you see the X-Men comic book, the implication is that the X-Men have now been around for so long that their early exploits were much in the same vein as, let's say, the Avengers' early exploits, or the Fantastic Four's early exploits. That's what they were. They were a young group trying to figure out how to be heroes in a world that didn't understand them or didn't get what they were trying.
Yeah.
So that's what I got from that, was that the growth was, that was their first adventure. Like, that was a long, we've learned a lot since then.
Exactly.
Yeah, we figured this shit out.
But the comic books also allowed for something else, where it allowed them to become the stuff of legend, like what from whatever the Arthurian legends may have emerged from, that become
their
the
mythology.
fabric of a future mythology. And of course, I just damn near wet myself when I saw Sauron cover.
the opening scene of the movie, we were jumping all over. The opening scene of the movie, we find Logan asleep in the backseat of his limo, jarred awake. We don't know exactly why, but he gets out and turns around and he finds some guys trying to steal the tires off of his car. And he's just – and the reason I bring this up is because this scene sets the tone for the mythology of the movie that we're going to be in.
Yeah.
You know, if this was the first, you know, the first line of the novel, you know, that's what this would be, you know. And he says to the guys, he's, you know, he's explaining, he's just exhausted. He's obviously, he's over it. He's not going to, you know, he's not going to jump out and pop his claws.
Yeah,
and yell,
like 40 years ago, it would have been, you know, it'd probably have grabbed one of them, slammed him up against the chassis and extended the right and left claw and looked at the other and says, your choice, his funeral, or something like that.
So, yeah. So instead he says, guys, come on, if you take them off like that, you're going to strip the chrome from the lug nuts. You know, he's just exhausted and trying to explain, just don't. I don't want to do this. Yeah. Can we not do this? And
it's,
I think,
like, there's no way you're going to win, but I don't want to get to the point where I have to show you.
But the most telling thing about this, right, is as famous as Wolverine is in the world that he's in, because he's a comic book character, he's been on TV, he's famous. The most telling part of the entire thing is he's finally like, oh, damn it, all right. And he pops his claws, and they don't bat an eye.
That's a good point. Yeah.
They don't run away. They don't scream. They don't just immediately start shooting. They're so adjusted to a world in which mutants exist that Wolverine pops his claws, and they're just like, all right, it's go time. Like, that's the react he gets. And that, for me, set the tone right away that this is a different world than any we've been in. You know, this has the X-Men in it, but this is a world where that's an accepted.
Nobody's surprised anymore.
Right. So they got what they wanted. And you know, and be careful, because you will reap what you sow. And also the part where his like left far claw went popped way out. He had to like God damn it.
And then later he has to like manually pull it out.
God, so brilliant. Just so, everything was so telling of the world. So let me ask you this, because, you know, there's a lot of things in the movie. We've talked about the fact, and we're probably not going to get into everything, you know, but we do have the introduction of X-23, his biological daughter, if not by the traditional means, you know, using his stuffs. They made a child that has been liberated by what has to be one of the greatest on-the-fly iPhone video editing jobs.
Oh, I know, man. Talk about some serious in-camera edits. We haven't seen the likes of this since Cloverfield.
Right? Somebody called Battleship Potankin because somebody had multiple cameras. There was a baby on a staircase.
Really?
Sergei
Eisenstein wants his cinematography back.
But that was my thought. I'm such an asshole when I watch movies. That was my initial thought. Was like, what, is Sarah McLachlan going to come on and ask me to give her a quarter to save these children? What the hell is happening here? But you know, we get the idea. Long story short, these kids are liberated from a facility where they were cloned to have mutant abilities.
Yeah, in the absolute best episode of Nurse Jackie ever.
Gets out. Well, you know, it takes a while, but Wolverine, Logan tags up with his, you know, legitimate daughter. They're being hunted by the special forces from this facility, trying to collect their property in the form of X-23 or Laura, who, by the way, in the comic books is now the Wolverine. There is no James Howlett per se. He's still dead. And so in the comics, we have Laura as the heir apparent to the Wolverine throne.
And I do have to say that, you know, from the advertising and such, I could tell that this character was meant to invoke or to be X-23. And we even we find out that her actual last name is 23.
Right, but
so
it's
like Lord Percy and Blackadder.
But it's French, so you never know.
It's like X-23, you know, it's like X-23 is her given name, 23 is her surname. So it's actually the full name is X-23 Howlett.
That's right. Laura X-23 Howlett is her name. But
so an address, or what are you saying?
So once he finally gives up and he agrees, because he is begged to do so by Professor X, takes her on the Blues Brothers road trip to North Dakota. Or I expected Lindsey Buckingham's Holiday Road to be playing at some point.
I expected them to just strap Xavier's remains on the
That would have been brilliant.
I guess they just didn't have a tarpaulin handy.
That would be brilliant. But you know, so they find out through a series of events, looking at the comic book and some various other things, that this utopia that exists in North Dakota is all based on the fiction of the comic books, which of course Wolverine knows is fiction.
Yeah, like, because damn you, Claremont. I didn't see.
Right. Art Adams can suck a dick. he knows. No, you can't, Art. You're amazing. I love your work. He knows that because he was there.
Yeah.
But he takes them anyway, you know, just because, you know, because it's as good a place as any to show her that life isn't what you think it is.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you just have to take people right to the precipice and say, well, there it is. There's your promised land.
The only problem is all the smart mutant kids decided that that's where they were going to meet, and there they all are. So they need to make an exodus across the Canadian border, at which point the climax, you know, happens and all the things go down. That's the story, you know. That's the elevator pitch. But
now, when you to just play a little bit about this, there's kind of a full circle sort of thing going on here, because Act 3 was very satisfying. I think we talked to before the show about it being very cathartic, in that afterward I was explaining to Catherine, I said Deadpool was sort of the first salvo in the X-Men Origins Wolverine apology cycle.
Right.
And this is the ultimate apology for that. Deadpool allowed the Merc with the Mouth to actually have a mouth.
Right.
But that was just sort of an opening the door, a trailblazer for this to give us the apology for the third act of Logan. Is sort of the do-over for the third act of X-Men Origins Wolverine, where you have Wolverine go in and free up a whole passel of a nuclear deterrent level pile of mutant children.
right.
Who, like, maybe, I think Cyclops maybe blew a hole in a wall.
Right, that's
you
it.
Know, why don't you aim those peepers to the other side of the room where they'll do some real damn good? You can blow holes exit strategies all day long. Killing off the bad guys would be kind of a good idea right now. So, you know, to see Plant Chick, just, you know, you think cedar allergies are bad. Wait till you're completely eviscerated by coniferous barks or...
By the way, that's what, the eighth album by Ultron Cafe? Carnivorous Barks?
Carnivorous Barks, yes.
It's like Pet Sounds, but with trees.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, they do come from a land full of piney woods and the land of the ice and snow.
Well, they'll come from on this album, kind of the first box. Yes,
we go back to our origins in our native land.
But no,
back
you're
to the land of our mothers and our fathers.
To take that sentiment one step further, right? I think that what we saw was the first adult comic book movie. And what I mean by that is, Deadpool was a rated R comic book movie, and it was damn near perfect for what it was trying to do. Like, I'll never, that, holy shit, I cannot get enough of that movie.
It can do no wrong. That's the kind of movie I want to see when I don't know what the hell I want to see.
Right, and I can watch it.
I think what you're looking for there is the first mature adult comic movie.
But I think what you saw was one eye firmly, firmly looking at not only the rest of the Marvel studios,
yeah,
but also the Warner Brothers studios.
Well, then again, I think I have to, though, say that the Dark Knight was the kind of open the door, because that really was the first tour adult comic book movie.
Yeah,
but this is the first one to take its themes to the ultimate extremes, but yet somehow make it approachable. I mean, it's a freaking bloodbath.
I just think thematically, this was an adult. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if legitimately somebody from this movie didn't come up for an Oscar next year.
Yeah.
Whether it's Patrick Stewart, whether it's Hugh Jackman, you know, this was a crafted film that was pointed at being a mature, real movie, not a niche superhero movie.
In much the same way that back when it came out, I said that The Dark Knight wasn't successful because it was a great Batman movie. It was successful because it was a great movie that happened to be about Batman. I think this is the same thing. It's on a much grander scale in many ways, but it is a great movie that just happens to have an X-Men theme.
Well, thematically, you've got the theme of family, what it means to have a family, what it means to be a father.
Yeah,
you've got
that family bullshit from the Fast and the Furious trailer. I saw. Oh, you're not family anymore. Shut up.
Four times they said family four times in that trailer in 3 minutes.
And I think it was even like spelled out like as a little.
It was a word.
So you had like spoken and then the written form, and then you go out in the lobby and the damn thing's on the poster. Family, shut up.
But that's what makes those movies great. Come on, you can have any beer you want as long as it's a Corona.
It's like the line in the obscure Roger Moore film, folks. It's like
there's a secret.
We drink whiskey in only one way. Neat.
Here's a secret for you. I personally believe that the Fast and the Furious movies might be the most enjoyable series of movies I've ever seen in my entire life. Just to sit back and watch on like a Deadpool level, they are amazing to watch. just holy shit. Fast and Furious 7 was better than Age of Ultron. I will say that, and I will stand by that. Age of Ultron.
I think a lot of movies that have followed Age of Ultron
were better. Yeah. But the themes of coming to terms. For instance, Cole, would you like to speak to the terms coming to terms with your past as it's portrayed? Because the theme of family in this movie, you know, you've got while Logan doesn't have a father, he has a father figure, and that father figure he's toting around in the back of a car entire time.
And the thing about it is, you have this sort of goading at some points where Xavier espouses disappointment in Logan,
mm-hmm.
and I think though that you're thinking, well, why? And then sometimes he's just almost beaming with pride without ever saying as much. And sometimes he's playful, and I think though that the wonderful subtle performance and the script itself, the dialogues that are acknowledging that Xavier is not all there. He's like the Estelle Getty of superheroes at this point, and he's like the oldest golden girl. He just says whatever comes in his head,
right?
Including like advertising the Taco Bell Crunchwrap to an audience of one.
I just love the fact that he cussed him out in the back of that car so many times.
There were so many little things that were saying this is Xavier, like you had mentioned earlier. All of the gentrification and all of the haughty professorial aspect has been shed in his old age, and you see that brilliantly illustrated in the hotel room when he's turned into a teenager or a preteen, mm-hmm. just giddily watching a favorite film. He's like going back to when he was her age.
Well, he has a grandkid. He never had a grandkid. So he has a grandkid in this film. The portrayal of...
If I'd knocked up that blue girl, I could have had grandkids by now.
The portrayal of Professor X by Patrick Stewart was very akin of the portrayal of Han Solo by Harrison Ford in the last Star Wars movie. It was Professor X's Make-A-Wish.
Yeah.
The last days of Professor X, get to do all the things you want, go on the final road trip, get to buy a jaunty little derby.
The scent of a mutant.
That was good. I like it. It's perfect. No, it was, and that's what you got. But you did see a father-son dynamic with Logan, and then you see a budding father-daughter dynamic with Laura and Logan, which was awesome.
Yeah, and I think that Professor X, his relationship with Professor X and constantly going trying to care for him and smuggling medicine in for him, kind of keeping him under the radar and keeping him protected, is sort of in deference to all that Professor X not only did for him, but all that Professor X represents.
Right.
And someone has to, take up the task of caring for him in his twilight years. And it's one of those things where Logan can't admit that he gives a damn.
He's forced to admit. That's the thing.
He's forced to admit.
Well,
that
because
he can care, and I think you know the wounds that don't heal are. I think an underlying theme in Wolverine's character is always the one wound he can't heal is his soul or his heart.
Sure.
In the spiritual sense, and so you know after so much loss and so much you know.
Well, there. So
and
he's seen. So
that,
in,
and I think though that also I forgot to mention. I think that the missing mutant issue.
Yes.
In many ways is suggestive of. It's not overt, but it is implicit that perhaps the whole X-Men Last Stand. Serum thing might have played a role.
Right, it could be that. It could be a Days of Future Past.
Yeah, like a vaccine against mutism.
But the brilliant part of the movie when it comes to that is that who cares?
Yeah, it doesn't
you know,
matter.
It could be so many things. If you know anything about the X-Men, it could be a million different reasons that they all got wiped out. Everything from weird Terrigen Mist to House of M to Days of Future Past to Stryker to the Serum to it could have been anything. You watch the movie, you might care for the first 30 minutes.
Exactly.
After that, you don't give a shit anymore about what happened because you're so enwrapped in this dynamic. And really, the dynamic is three characters, and that's all that really matter. The part that I think bothers me the most, but I completely understand why they did it, is so they have a X-23 – was the Wolverine clone that turned out to be a quote-unquote failure because it had free will and they got it out and now she's on the road with Wolverine. Yeah. And every time they stop at a gas station, she tries to kill someone, but it's still all good. It was X-24. That's the only part that I get it, but I didn't care for. X-24, so if you've seen the movie, you know that X-24 is the de-aged Uncanny Valley clone of old Logan, otherwise known, you know, Logan from the first X-Men movie.
When he first show up, for the briefest moment, I thought it was Sabretooth.
And I wished it would have been. And maybe that's the nerd boy in me wishing it was a Sabretooth clone. I think for me, that would have been impressive. But they needed to sell the part. I'm admitting this now. This is the first, and I probably won't be the last, but this is the first comic book movie that I actually shed a real human tear during. Yeah. And it was during this scene because Professor X wakes up, has a little soliloquy about how it's the perfect night and the moon is coming up over the cornfields outside of Eric LaSalle's house. The water's turned back on. Yeah. Everything seems to be functioning well.
The toilet flushes when I take a shit.
And he says, you know, he admits at this point that he's done bad things.
Yeah.
You know, he's having a moment of clarity. He's realizing that Westchester, something happened. Thousands of people were hurt or killed. But this night, this is the last good night. He's kind of acknowledging
that. Yeah, sort of like the first and last good night ever.
And he's telling Logan not to wake Laura, let her sleep for another hour. You know, this is good. And then all of a sudden, three fucking claws through the chest.
Yeah.
And you're just like, fuck. Because you see him come out of the shadows, and it's obviously Wolverine's face. But what you don't realize is that it's a clone. It's X-24. It's Wolverine bred to kill and not with no human emotion. But it's also that weird Uncanny Valley Tarkin de-aged Wolverine where I'm like, ugh, I don't like looking at this. It makes me uncomfortable. But the part that made me literally shed a tear in the movie theater was after they got out. Professor X. Logan was carrying Professor X out to the truck, and repeating over and over again, "It wasn't me. It wasn't me.
Yes.
It wasn't me." Like that, you have to know this. It wasn't me. That was saying. That was admitting that familial love right there that we had not seen. This means so much to me to know that for you to know that I didn't do this. That I, you know, I might be a feral, you know, rage beast, but this wasn't me. I didn't do this. And that part choked me up real good. I was like, shit. But yeah, talk to me about that.
Yeah, and he didn't
concept.
Have to like drive by the backhoe and say, look, it wasn't me. There he is. There's the guy that stabbed you.
Right. He wasn't saying it for him.
Yeah.
He was saying it for he wasn't saying it for Professor X. He was saying it for him.
But also I think it was both an admonition of that. An admission of love and also an admonition, a realization that this is the end. And
right.
If Xavier's going to die, he can't die with you know, the thought that it, of Wolverine killing him.
Right, right. Yes, for sure.
I don't want you to go to your grave thinking I'm the one who did this to you.
Yeah, especially absolutely.
But, you know, the other thing, going back to kind of the road picture idea, is that there was some just wonderful, delightful humor.
Oh, good.
Kind of like, and in many ways, it almost became Shakespearean in its structure, in that you would have this, like, you know, we talked about Sam Peckinpah level violence, this sort of,
oh my god,
just, you know,
wild bunch eyeballs flying out violence.
And then you get to have these wonderful scenes, like encountering the ER family there on their horse ranch. You know, the like when he's trying to get out of their invitation for dinner, and Professor X, and then, you know, presenting himself as, you know, grandfather, father, and daughter,
right,
and calling him Chuck.
The scene in the gas station was pretty great too.
Yes, that was awesome.
Like, all of those little asides were great. The where he goes back in to save her, to basically save the gas station attendant.
Yeah, constantly being brutally murdered.
Right. But on his way out grabs a cell phone charger, but also grabs a handful of cigars.
Yes, exactly.
Like, as a nod, you know.
Yeah.
That he's feeling himself again, yeah. You know. It was so good.
Wonderful little things where it repeatedly, you know, gave you a lot of high impact stuff when it needed to, but it didn't feel like it had always to that.
Well, they did a great job. The movie almost felt like the movie was filmed for a grandfather, a father, and a daughter driving across country, taking her to her friends so she could get out of the country. And then during the filming, they were hijacked by these guys trying to stop it. That's the way it was filmed. It was brilliantly filmed. Like, it felt like they were intruding. You weren't waiting for the bad guys to show up and cause some shit, right? You were waiting for them to get to North Dakota, and these bad guys kept showing up. And you were like, why the... Stop it. We want them to be... You know, it wasn't X-Men...
How many Reavers do you have? I mean, I felt like I was watching The Walking Dead. It seems like there's an endless supply of dead people. non-stop... They've got this incredible, like, Cold War budget they're still plowing through to cybernetically enhance 700 guys to be on call with impunity in... I guess it's some sort of weird NAFTA thing where they can operate with just complete disregard in Mexico. But goddamn, if they cross the border into Canada, we can't go there. when was Canada a place you can't go and raise hell?
Well, you know why? Because Alpha Flight's
That's
up there.
Right. Yeah, they don't want to raise hell. It's Sasquatch.
Which is what all those kids become. That would be fantastic, by the way. If they were greeted at the border by Vindicator and Sasquatch and Puck, oh my god. I would have blown 8 loads. But that's the way it felt to me. Like, I didn't want the fight scenes as much as I wanted the intimate storytelling between the three of them. And anytime I felt intruded upon by the bad guys. Like, okay, they have to fight now because they pissed me off because I was enjoying what was happening before they got here. Not waiting on the big Marvel, you know.
It had to remind you periodically that you're watching effectively a superhero or a comic book movie.
Right.
It's like, oh, by the way, this isn't, you know, some sanguine Robert Redford picture that made all the buzz at Sundance.
It could have been, though. That's
I know. But
cut the movie down to an hour and a half, and you've got a tight little, like you said, Cannes Film Festival winner of just a road movie between a daughter.
Well, what it did was alternate between Cannes and Cannes.
That's true. Also, it didn't have my biggest gripe about it is that it didn't have Bonebreaker in it. I was really waiting. I was hoping that they
Bonebreaker the one I call Attaboy.
Yes,
the all terrain armored boy.
If they would have just taken one guy.
I kept waiting for. I didn't know his name, but I was like half expecting that the closest thing we're gonna get is like the guys hopping on the back of the truck for the heavy artillery there. You know, it's like, where's the guy with the tank for an ass?
Well, they could have just literally taken one of those little ATV type.
Yeah, just have a guy who just drives around in one, or like get Peter Dinklage back, just put a big beard on him and a mohawk.
I'm telling you, man, they dropped the ball on that. But outside of the fact that I really didn't like just the idea of X-24, I think maybe, but I get it. And the reason that I get it, and maybe you can help me with this, articulate this,
I will help you through this jungle here. I will get you to the border.
Is that what we're, and we're going to go long tonight. We're talking about this. We're going to go a little long.
This is like Daredevil level.
Yeah, we're going to go for another 15, 20. I realized that basically, hey, here's a spoiler, Wolverine dies at the end.
Yeah.
Okay, out there, if you know it, if you haven't seen it and you're listening to this, that's on you. Is he had to fight himself at a younger age and in order to put a nail in that coffin.
Yeah.
To prove that he was better than he was when he was, you know, just starting in this. How does that work for you? How do you explain that?
Because I'm not going to be able. You know, to for kill. Me, I wasn't as bothered by X-24 as you were.
I was bothered by the look of him, and just.
I guess that, because I was latching so much onto the Sabretooth concept, I was a little bothered by the fact that for some reason, if you're a 6-year-old, you only get 2 claws and foot claws.
Right.
Apparently, that's. I guess if you're cloning Wolverine, you're going to get a Wolverine.
Right.
Dolly the sheep didn't have that freakish head of the bum on the street / his dog from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Donald Sutherland. The clone sheep came out looking like a sheep. Ben Reilly apparently comes out looking entirely different than Peter Parker. I don't know. I don't clone. But you know, I guess if you're going to clone Wolverine with his bone claws,
right,
you're gonna get a Wolverine clone with 3 bone claws in each, somehow crammed amidst the lower arm bones in such a way that they fluidly move out of the way when you want to twist your arm to, I don't know, punch somebody or go to putt-putt, but you know, I'm sorry, when you're hitting the links, even in a miniature form, you actually have to let the radius and ulna kind of move in concert. But really, I think that you're on the right track with trying to justify that younger, older self, that he becomes the dark mirror.
Right.
And he has to face himself to ultimately die the hero.
Well, and I think that the brilliant thing that they did was they had Laura fight, and ultimately, which by the way was the greatest nod to the original Logan movie, the original Wolverine Origins movie, is he's been carrying this adamantium bullet with him.
Yes.
But using it to having Laura kill young Wolverine, showing that in my mind, showing that that's not the way it has to be this thing. You don't have to be an animal. You don't have to be a monster, you know. And then that was what that was showing, was that you can
and it's funny, you know,
bury
you
that.
Mentioned that the only thing that really struck me as poorly played, the one point where they went into the chestnut of conceit that otherwise they had, you know, we spoke earlier about in the first act, you get the Reavers coming in to capture her, and
right,
she is not going to put down her Cinnamon Toast Crunch to be bothered by them till they're within a claw's length. But you don't have to see, like, you know, for the 3D edition, a slow motion, you know, flying about of breakfast cereals and body parts.
Right, right.
You just, it's all implicit. And there was one point where I felt they missed the implication ball, and that's where she spots the gun, and then they have to go out of their way to have her go back and find the gun and show her loading it up.
Right.
I think had you taken, you could excise that shot completely from the film and give the audience just the fact that she sees the gun and trust that your audience remembers she's got possession of the bullet.
I would.
Otherwise, it just becomes Walter White's brother-in-law.
I can argue a counterpoint here.
But that's only, you know, one fluid shot where this is for many.
My counterpoint argument to that is all we have seen her do the entire movie is react, right? She's essentially a feral animal.
She is herself the weapon that you...
Right.
I mean, the gun doesn't know what the gun does. The gun just does.
So she's at the table eating, like you said, her Cinnamon Toast Crunch. They come in. She plays them to get close enough.
Yeah.
You know, when she does the same thing every single time, right? So when her and Wolverine are fighting in concert, you know, they're playing a pack animal game. Mm. This is her finding, when you show her finding the gun, loading the gun, aiming the gun, firing the gun, you're showing a thinking person. you know, this is a decision that she's making to protect someone. This is a decision that she's making to put down the animal. So this is her growth. I think you have to make it long. I think you have to make it drawn out. I think you have to show every step in that process.
I can see where you're coming from there, because that does, in a way I hadn't realized at first blush, it does allow her to have seen the gun. And by showing her see the gun, then you see that registration of here is a opponent. She knows she has the bullet.
Right.
She sees the gun and knows the two are, you know, two parts of a greater whole.
Sure.
And I think that, yeah, that does sort of her going back to retrieve the gun and load the gun suggest then that she's made the connection that the only way you can put down the Wolverine clone is the only way Wolverine himself could fathom putting himself down.
Right. And I think it shows character in a real weird way. It shows character growth from when we first see her to when we last see her, which is going from a feral wolf child.
Yeah.
To what is essentially, if not the leader of this band of quote unquote new mutants, mm-hmm. at least a functional member that isn't an animal. And that is, you know, in any other part of the movie, she would have just jumped onto that Wolverine clone's back and just clawed and bit and you know,
which she had already done. And I think that's another thing that adds poignancy to her,
right?
To that
right.
maneuver, is she's already had the scene where she's just, you know, stabbing him from every conceivable angle.
Ape shit.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing they did better with that character with X-23 that I've ever seen in any movie like that before is just her going ape shit.
Yeah, I mean, literally from thorax to nutsack, there wasn't a part of him that hadn't been pierced.
Right. And that's the thing. This movie, you call it Sam Peckinpah's National Lampoon's Vacation, whatever analogy you want to derive from it. But the quick expert level violence that is meted out by both Wolverine and X-23 is second to none. Just precision gore, just straight through the head.
And also, yeah, exactly. They're shooting to kill. But here's a question I want to pose in this context. Is it possible to have what would be otherwise gratuitous violence be meaningful within the context of a story? And the answer is yes. I'm going to go ahead and reveal that right now.
Thank you, Cole.
Because this isn't one of my damn game shows at AllCon next week. ALL-CON.net. We hope to see you there. Free parking. plug. The answer is yes, because in the scene where Charles has his seizure in the casino.
Oh, my God.
And Wolverine or Logan has to, you know, literally claw his way into the room.
Right.
And he sees, frozen in the doorway, one of the Reavers, gun, you know, at the ready, triggered just shy of being pulled. And then upon taking in the entire scene within the room there, you get what would otherwise be gratuitous violence in that, you know, he first guy takes a shot to the head with three claws, and then he subsequently, as he's, you know, working his way across the room, pauses long enough to murder every single person before. I mean, they literally, they see it coming.
They can't stop it.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
You know, it's just
the
like,
worst.
Here is, I'm going to be dead. And they can't even wet themselves. Because
right.
Everything is frozen and death is creeping along at, you know, this snail's pace. And that would otherwise be gratuitous for the fact that if you look at it on the whole, what he is seeing is once they, you know, they Pulp Fiction and give him the shot, the only other outcome is either all these people have to be dead.
Right.
Or there is going to be a god-awful mess, in which case Xavier could not possibly survive.
Correct.
Because they're going to, the second they can, they're going to pick up the firefight they were about to engage in.
Well, I think the idea is that as soon as that seizure's over, or as soon as Xavier drops his guard, all those triggers are pulled.
Exactly.
They're dead.
He has to eliminate those threats before they can be enacted.
Right.
And he is uniquely positioned to do so. And so I thought it was a wonderful, if such a thing can be said to be wonderful, is to take something so dramatically and drastically violent, and it's sort of sublimed by the actual plot.
Right.
So I thought it was a rather remarkable. And can we take a moment, because we've gone this entire show and we have not talked at all about my absolute favorite Marlon Brando as Dr. Moreau and the Island of Dr. Moreau cosplayer.
He was brilliant. He was great in this movie. If you haven't gone back and look, if you go to he's a comedian. He's a writer, and he's also does. If you go look at Jimmy Fallon, he does the lip sync battles. He was the institutor of the lip sync battles. If you can go back and find video of him doing like Baby Got Back and stuff. This the actor that did Caliban.
Well, what was wonderful for me about Caliban is when you first get to see him outside of his Cassidy from Preacher outfit,
yeah,
or the Phantom Gardener, call him what you will, once he's out in his pajamas there, running around doing the housework in the absolutely worst house in town, I'm thinking, oh, this would be so cool if it's Calibac, but it's not going to be.
Yeah.
It's just going to be, because we can't do that.
No.
X-Men Last Stand proved we can't do that. And then they went and proved me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't prove me wrong immediately. They went like, hey, Calibac, how's it going? You're like 10 minutes in from the point you first see him walk up and then, and like, look, Mommy, all the stuff I got at the thrift store to the name actually being spoken aloud. And I thought that was a wonderful reveal because it allowed the character to just be whatever the hell this guy is. You know, he's an albino. What does he know? And to the actual fanboy reveal.
Right. And
because Calibac means nothing to anybody but fanboys.
Right.
And so it didn't have to be Calibac, but that it was, and they acknowledged it. I think you mentioned they didn't go with the Kala-Hulk.
Right. They didn't go with the giant Rob Liefeldian monster guy. They did a brilliant job of, you know, if there is a familial unit there, Caliban was the ant.
Calibac. I kept calling him Calibac, who was, of course, from the New Gods.
Right.
So Darkseid's half
torturer,
or something.
Yeah, something. But they imbued him with this, and I say this within reason, this kind of bird's cage, the bird's cage Nathan Lane quality, this nurturing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, there's this strangely nurturing,
like the lion in the birdcage. He's practically abreast.
Yeah, like it was unassuming and nurturing, and you know,
I hadn't thought about it, but he's Albert from the Birdcage.
Yeah, like to be sitting on the front porch of the place with like a linen suit and a hat, you know, a wide brimmed hat on, like, warm today. It's gonna be warm. Won't you get on inside, get your mint julep, boy? You look warm.
You're half expected to say, well, I wanted to get filet mignon, but they're so expensive.
Right. Like, but it was so brilliantly played that affectation seemed natural.
Yeah.
That was a part of their familial unit. You know, it was almost an Arthur Miller play up to the point at which you realize that this is an X-Men movie where you had Caliban and you had Wolverine come in with his sleeveless t-shirt and his jeans too tight. Like, I had a hard day at the office, just lay off me, and threw his jacket. You know, what's wrong with you? We never talk anymore. Like, well, Dad's sick in the broken down water tower out back and you don't help around here. And you know, like,
and I spent all day folding your underpants and all you want to do is go to sea.
It, right? It's like, you can we talk about your drinking? Like, you know, it's like you get this brilliant one act stage play for the first
in the middle of a movie. Yeah.
Of the movie. Like, what the hell is going on? This is amazing.
So you this go is from an X-Men like gangsta movie. Slaughter to community theater production.
Like that's so crazy to think about. Like, and then all of a sudden, guys with cybernetic arms are showing up with MP4s and like, what? I don't understand.
How many things are in this movie? Like, how
what
many
is
movies
this movie?
Are in this movie? Yes,
what
indeed.
Is this movie?
And what I loved about the makeup effects of Caliban as well was they made him just enough inhuman, but not as inhuman as he was as a Morlock. It kind of,
right, right.
You know, Art Adams made him like just shy of Gollum.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't take him that far, but they took him enough away by, you know, kind of pushing the eyeballs back into the sockets just enough to make him a little, you know, he isn't just an albino who happens to have a mute power. There's some physical manifestations there as well. Kind of like poor, Lizard Larry there in the New Mutants.
And I love the fact that he pays homage to that himself when he says, you know, what am I supposed to do? I'm hide in the I forget what he's hiding the something like Nosferatu.
Oh yeah,
like, he makes his own reference to that.
The fact that he, you know, while they're up enjoying the splendor of the open ocean, he gets to be down in steerage.
Oh, that's what it was. It was on the ship. That's yeah. Right. And the
he's been like Leonardo DiCaprio in the Titanic, only he doesn't get an invite to the fancy dinner party.
Well, and I think that the two, as we wind this up, I think we should talk about the two burials that we see in the film, and the first one being Charles Xavier's burial, where it was I think it was way too unceremonious for Logan even at yeah. that point, and him trying to articulate his emotions. Again, we go back to that one act Harold Pinter Arthur Miller play where he's talking about trying to get out the words to, you know, we're by the water, you know, the sun seeker, and he's trying to describe that, and then ends up just taking a shovel to his
the non-working truck.
Yeah.
And I also like the implication that, to me, there was a tremendous implication that she doesn't have to kill, that perhaps the incident at the convenience store
yeah.
rubbed off on her enough. I like to imagine that the fisherman and his dog are still very much alive if stranded.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you don't have to just take things.
Or you don't have to kill to take things, you know?
Right, and we've completely laid off of the fact that the urgent care doctor was a Wolverine fanboy.
Yeah,
that was funny. That was really funny.
That was nice. And as on the subject of death, before we get to the second burial, the Caliban has a very redeeming death as well, because I think he, at this point, having been, you know, tortured, as he, you know, tells the doctor, you know, this guy's torturing me. he's kind of that way.
he's just, you know, that's what he does.
But I think he comes to the realization that there's no getting out of this. There's no returning. You know, they're not going to just drive back to Mexico and, you know, set him loose to go tend to Charles's garden. Mm-hmm. There is no good outcome that's going to come from this, and he chooses his own path rather than having it forced upon him by these creeps.
Right.
And with a very hopeful notion of undermining their plans.
Yeah, and does it.
Yeah.
At that.
And so it does. You get that little sense of redemption there, and him rising to an even greater place than just simply when he was helping out Wolverine washing his tights. And,
right.
And then, of course, you do get the one of the best hero deaths since probably Paul Verhoeven's Excalibur.
Very true. Why don't you describe what we see? I don't know if we.
I don't know if you need me to fill in the blanks of. King Arthur being spitted on Mordred's spear,
yeah.
and just sort of dragging himself up to the point where he could stab his bastard son. But you get this really. I mean, you have Wolverine in decline, and at every turn, somebody's reminding him, "Oh, by the way, that glaucoma ain't exactly healing itself." Or
right,
you know.
Whatever it is, yeah.
You know, they probably have polyps the size of cantaloupes in your asshole right now because you don't have anything holding them at bay anymore. But, you know, and especially like in the urgent care clinic where you see that, you know, this massive rent, this San Andreas fault across his midriff.
Right.
That is the aftermath of his battle with his younger self. So you have, you know, the Wolverine in decline, that even at the point where there's not much left, he's still fighting to the last.
Right.
And then he ultimately does get, in a way, a that moment of peace that Charles Xavier had found prior to his death. I think you actually have a bit of a dichotomy or a reflection there in each of them, is that they and you also see this sort of sense of resignation that in many ways sort of combines that of man and animal in one sort of fell swoop, and that the one thing that is not unique to man is that sort of just resignation that the end has come. And you'll see that in animals that are, you know, have just not, hopefully not to get too grim here, but I saw this thing where, you know, a buffalo that was bitten by a Komodo dragon, and it took about 3 or 4 days for it to finally die, and you see this, you know, massive lizard just relentlessly following it as it struggles to survive, and then you see this sense, just this almost uncanny sense of resignation that the end has arrived, and just sort of gives up the ghost. And, you know, the fact that she's there behind him, you know, trying to lumberjack him out of the tree stump while he, you know, he probably, because at that point it doesn't really matter that he might have lived about 9 seconds longer if she hadn't added that trauma.
Right.
But at least she had the good sense not to try to pull the rest of the stump out.
Well, and you know, I think the idea is that there was you're right, there was a resignation, but there was also the my job is done.
Yeah.
Like, I've got her to where she needs to be and these kids to where they need to be to get across the border. I have defeated the clone of myself. Charles is dead. He doesn't need me to protect him anymore. Caliban is
yeah, as far as he knew, Caliban was on the roadside in Mexico.
Right.
Feeding vultures.
So I'm finally at peace. I've experienced family, and now I can go. And I think that burial was amazing. The kids burying the Red Dawn kids burying.
Yeah, well, you'd have to. Red Dawn is your watchman, I think.
It is, yes.
It's your go-to. But no, I like the fact that they had them, you know, construct a burial cairn rather than, like, you know, have Richter force the earth open to give him a pristine, you know, 6x9 grave or some bullshit like that. They actually use their people hands to do people work.
And
to cover him up and make a cross. It wasn't even like, there wasn't even the implication that Flower Girl there somehow, you know, she didn't like swamp thing a bunch of trees into a cross shape. They just like got some twigs and lashed them together with grasses. And then probably when they were done, like, you know, you could have done this.
And the speech at the end.
Yes.
The callback speech just, that's so good.
What was wonderful about that is she knows enough to know this is a time for words.
Yeah.
And that's all. Those are the only words she knows. She doesn't have. I like the fact that the actress who played her, by the way, was absolutely brilliant.
Caster Scott.
Because she could convey not only that animal ferocity, but she also had this amazing sense of wonder. Because this was the first time, inside or outside of comics, where a laboratory creature, as it were, from a comic scenario was illustrating. You know, one of the things that always bugged me about things like Gen 13 or that god awful crap that followed, I can't remember, there was some like stupid image thing that these characters were all supposed to be like
DV8. You know,
was DV8 the one where like the guy had like bite tattooed across his chest?
Yes.
Like, okay, if you were genetically engineered in the lab and trained within an insular type of situation, you know, that's what was so troublesome to me about the Clone Wars. You know, I'm sorry, I get it. You came up with this stupid chestnut. You explained it all away that after they had a big enough clone army, they decided they had to, like, attach names to some of them to make it.
Right.
So they didn't have to call, you know, try to figure out what number they were sequentially, because once you get in the 2 or 3 million, it gets to be a little troublesome to call roll. But even then, you know, when you call life into existence, and you give it a human form, and you fill its empty slate brain with propaganda and the mechanisms of war, or whatever you've designed to do, chances are you don't have a tattoo parlor on site. And chances are that genetically engineered, artificially filled mind doesn't have any inclination to ever want to get tatted up.
Sure.
So unless you had a production designer on staff at the lab who thought, you know what we ought to do with these guys is make them look really hip, it becomes one of the stupidest things in the world. And I like the fact that she had this sense of, none of this is in her wheelhouse.
Right. Oh, that's so good.
She is in this vast new world that, you know, her world was a handful of hallways and walls and torture chambers.
Right.
She'd never known bright lights and television and soft beds and, you know, telephones, a bit of honey candy bar. None of this exists in her world.
Right. And the only eulogy she can give.
Warriors, by the way.
And the only eulogy that she can possibly give is the last lines of the movie Shane.
Yeah.
And it was so beautifully fitting to what they were trying to do. There's no more guns in the valley. God, so good. So good.
My final thought on that was she so stole my idea when they buried Xavier.
Which was?
They should have made like a little X for him.
Oh.
By way of a cross. And then she's departing. Somebody spent a lot of time making that cross and getting to shove it in the ground. And then she comes along. And, I'm gonna mix. Good thing nobody else saw her.
And we were talking before the show.
Because Larry the Lizard probably put that in their space. He's a little sensitive.
He looks a little sensitive. We were talking before the show that it would have been, we were saying it would have been so easy at that point to have one of the rocks from the Karn shift.
Yes.
Or something like that happen.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen ending.
And then they didn't. They stuck the landing. They're like, this is it. He's dead. That's the end of the story. This version of Wolverine is done.
Suck on it, Darth Maul fanboys.
And
you
I
lost
think that,
this one.
I think of all of the things that this movie did, that was possibly the most important was we're putting this to bed.
Yeah.
It has to start happening. It can't continue to be. We can't have Chris Evans playing Captain America for another 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
The time has to come.
Think about it, the man's been playing this character at intervals for nearly two decades.
Yeah, 17 years. 17 years that he's been playing this character. I couldn't drink when he started playing this character.
At least not legally.
Right. So it's time. We have to give up our heroes at some point. That's the way it works. Oh, my God.
Was a fitting farewell. I think it was one of the most satisfying farewells in cinema, one of the, most meaningful deaths of a major character.
So do you have any final thoughts? We need to wrap. We need to close up shop
Yes, we really do. At this point, go see it again is basically, because you better have seen it before you listen to all this, or we've pretty much... we're going to rob it of all of its poignancy because you're not going to get it in any kind of order.
Right.
But I think that this ideally is going to send the kind of message to Hollywood that it needs to be sent. This and Deadpool both, and by the way, we can't talk about this without saying that how amazingly brilliant was the bumper at the beginning for Deadpool, that somehow you can make it funny some guy got murdered in a robbery attempt. and we're okay with that.
We're awful people. That's what it comes down to.
But these are the movies that are going to send a signal that we hope. And the practical upside of this will be that some studios will stop meddling so much and start letting the story craft be king, not the what they think people need to have. And the other thing is, the downside of this is I'm afraid that it's going to be like, R-rated movies. That's
what
we
need. Yeah, that's my fear, for sure. Cole, what do you say? Are you ready to wrap this up?
I think we absolutely need to, just for the sake of...
people's sanity? Yeah, I agree.
Exactly.
All in all, man, yeah, you're right. Everybody just needs to, if you haven't seen it, see it. If you have seen it, go see it again. It's brilliant. So why don't you plug us up, Cole, and we'll get out of here for the evening.
Absolutely. Well, we're, of course, coming to you from the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us about Wolverine, Schnicky Schnick, or anything else you want to at jcumail@yahoo.com. Watch for our schnickety tweets at... on Twitter.
No.
God, I'm getting so tired. at the Jedi Cole U.
And you said schnickety tweets. Sorry. Okay. I'm good now. I'm back now. That was funny. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. That was just really funny, Cole.
I don't know what schnickety. I'm sorry. I'm still recovering from schnickety tweets. Apparently, schnickety tweets was actually my stage name when I was trying to ride the coattails of the Chris Farley and Patrick Swayze. Was it Chippendales?
Yes.
Sketch. And I thought maybe that was just sort of the signal that it was time for more husky.
To get off the stage?
Yeah,
no, I'm just still laughing at schnickety tweets.
Yeah.
I want you to finish closing out the show. I'm sure people want to know about Alcon a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, in addition to schnickety tweets, you can get your fill of them at Alcon at alcon.net. It is 4 full days of amazing programming in Addison, Texas from March 16th to 19th. In fact, it starts on the 15th, the night before, with the Pajama Jam pajama party on Wednesday night, which is free to get in that, free all day Thursday. If you want to just check out Alcon on March 16th. Festivities begin at 10 a.m. with myself and the Rancor Pit's own Eddie Medina as we present Alcon in 60 Minutes, the annual opening ceremonies, in which I will be presenting a brand new feature, Alcon History in 60 Seconds. I will give you the previous 12 years of Alcon in 1 minute. And, of course, Eddie and I will be doing some various Star Wars-themed game shows. There are other, I think, 30-some-odd game shows this year. There's over 400 different things going on. And I'm in about 30-odd some of them myself. my talk shows are back, of course, the Jedi Cult Universe Live and the longest-running talk show at Alcon, but oddly enough, not the first, though I did produce the very first talk show at Alcon. And Mrs. Jedi Cole and I produced the very first game show at Alcon, and in both cases, they just keep going strong. This is a record year for game shows. Talk shows, JCU Live, and of course, the longest-running talk show, Jedi Cole's Morning After, on Sunday morning, for those of you not too hungover from Saturday night's room parties and such. But we're talking about over 400 hours of programming over 4 days. That's for those of you trying to work out the math on that. It's because there are multiple tracks happening simultaneously. But you're talking about like over 400 different things going on concurrently over 4 days. $55, I believe it is, to get a full weekend pass.
Right.
There are shows you can't get in for 1 day here locally for $55, and they're not offering you near as much. So be sure and check that out. And you can also buy by the day. Friday and Saturday are $35 adult, $20 children, $20 for Sunday only, or $10 for kiddos. But trust me, it's worth the investment. Come out all 4 days. It's your favorite con. Go to all-con.net.org. I think all of them will bring you to the Alcon. Free parking, no matter what the hotel tells you. Alcon has covered the parking for the weekend for its attendees. 2 floors of exciting entertainment. The 13th year of Alcon. How many people have told me, oh, I've never heard of that? 13 years it's been around in your own backyard if you live in the Dallas area.
That's right.
And if you don't, you owe it to yourself. Andrew Farmer himself has come down from Ohio many times to be a part of Alcon.
It's not just a convention. You go to every other convention to be at a convention. You are a part of this convention. If you go to this convention, you will be a part of the convention. You will never want to leave, and you will come back every single year. Trust me, I know. It pains me greatly that I'm not going this year. I have every intention of planning well in advance to go next year. All right, Cole, we're gonna wrap this bad boy up. Do you wanna say good night?
Good night, everybody, and schnickety tweets from.
Remember, the next schnickety tweets will be there's no more guns in the valley. Thanks everybody. Join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics. Good night,
bubs.
Oh, damn it.